From the National Weather Service on this Thursday, November 15th. Partly sunny, 50% chance of rain and or snow showers late this morning or early this afternoon. Today's high 39. New numbers just in, wind from the north at 3, 33 degrees Kenosha, 32 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. There's lots going on this weekend here in southeastern Wisconsin, including 2 theatrical performances that we're going to be talking about. In part 1, Opera Workshop at Carthage Saturday afternoon. Part 2, a one-man show that is coming to UW Parkside Friday night. Stay with us. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part 1 of a 2-part morning show today, we're going to be talking about Carthage College's Opera Workshop performance, which is coming up this Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock in the recital hall. And it's, for once, a non-operatic production. We are, instead of presenting opera music, presenting examples of the magnificent world of art songs, specifically the art songs of Franz Schubert. And with me is Allison Hull, who is one of the teachers who is co-directing Opera Workshop this weekend, and one of the students who's involved in the performance, Joey Bellotti. We'll hear from Joey in a second. First, I'm going to ask Allison Hull to explain this thing called a Schubertiade, which is a very special kind of gathering and one that is going to be, in a sense, recreated Saturday afternoon. Allison Hull, explain what a Schubertiade was.
Sure, my pleasure. So it was very fashionable in Schubert's time for groups of artists, musicians, painters, great thinkers of the time to get together and sort of have a salon. And a Schubertiade is a specific form of the salon in that it's the music of Franz Schubert that gets performed. So what we're depicting here are actual characters drawn from Schubert's circle of friends, artists of the day, friends of his, people that he worked with, some aristocratic figures. And all of these are drawn from real life, as I said, and we're kind of depicting an evening of what might actually happen at a Schubertiade.
So explain to our listeners what they will experience aside from the songs of Schubert. What else is woven into the performance?
Sure. We try to recreate a salon kind of setting with the furniture and the costumes and a bit of dialogue and sort of what these people might say to one another, how they might introduce their pieces. And in this particular production, Greg Berg actually provided us with a wonderful script to work from. So we have some great interchanges with these characters, how they interact with one another and set things up. We also will be playing a parlor game in the second act of our piece, which was something very popular at the time to kind of lighten the mood, get people's spirits up and ready for some more music, but to also sort of break the form of song after song after song.
Right. And last quick question before you have to go. Just say a word about these students, many of whom are relatively young and inexperienced, but who have been working really, really hard to make this work.
My gosh, I'm I'm beyond impressed with the students that we're featuring. Not just their voices, we have some really magnificent voices up there, but how they're interacting with each other and supporting one another and handling the dialogue and handling the requirements that the period presents.
Very good. Allison Hull is one of the co-directors of Opera Workshop this weekend, this semester, I should say. Thank you so much for joining me for this part of the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
I want to turn now to Joey Bellotti, who is a student at Carthage, and some of you may recognize the name because Joey has actually been on the morning show one previous time when
right.
he and two of his closest friends came on the morning show to talk about the music group that they're part of, namely The Bugs. Which is a well-known group in the Kenosha area. But Joey Bellotti has put away the Beatles for the moment and is taking up the songs of Franz Schubert and is part of this Opera Workshop presentation, which is, again, Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. So, Joey, you were assigned a really interesting character,
yes.
an exceptionally interesting character to portray in this performance on Saturday afternoon. Tell our listeners who you are portraying and sort of the fun opportunities that this particular character presents to you.
Yes. So, as you know, as I actually learned, Franz von Schobert, the character who I will be playing this Saturday, is... He lived a very questionable lifestyle and is responsible for what people think, you know, to be the death of Franz Schubert. And he, along with a lot of other friends, would gather at the Schubertiads, as Allison said, and they would sing and eat, dance, and it would be a very, very fun experience. And if I could just say this whole opportunity has widened my, you know, horizon, kind of broadened, you know, what it is to perform and to really cherish these songs that I would not have otherwise really known.
Hmm. Tell our listeners a little bit about the personality of Franz von Schubert, not only the way he's written in this script, but what you are bringing to the part. I mean, what kind of personality does he stir into the mix?
Well, he's an arrogant guy. He likes to think he's better than most, but he's down to earth. He's a fun character. He likes to party. He likes to drink. He's a flirtatious fellow, so to speak, kind of represents the wrong crowd that Schubert himself was a part of during his lifetime. But yeah, overall, it's a great experience with friends, new friends that I was able to meet. And just have to give you a shout out, Greg, for writing the script and being our pianist, playing the pianoforte, as they called it. yeah, it's really a wonderful, wonderful performance. And you would not, by chance, happen upon a performance like this in your day-to-day lives. It is a special thing that we're putting on at Carthage, among the many special opportunities and chances that students get here at Carthage College.
So we want to remind people it's this Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. It's called To Schubert, a gathering of friends and admirers to celebrate the music and legacy of Franz Schubert. And to whatever extent is possible, it is a recreation of one of these Schubertiads where such friends and admirers would gather in someone's home and have an evening together, kind of an interesting mix of formality and informality. And at the heart of it, of course, this array of wonderful songs by Franz Schubert. So, for instance, you will be singing part of one of his most famous songs,
yes.
The Erl King, and then singing as a solo a song of his called Die Post, which is
yep.
very dramatic and theatrical, which is one of the reasons we gave it to you.
Yeah.
Explain to our listeners what the song Die Post is about and what makes it fun to sing.
Well, the song Die Post means the post. It's about a postman who the singer sees arriving to a city that he is living in on horseback, and he believes that the postman is carrying a letter from his former lady love, but it turns out not to be the case, and he asks the postman to go back to that city and send word of his love for his lover that lived there. And it's a touching song. It's a fun song. And it's a pleasure to sing, really. And once you dig into the German, because, of course, all of the songs that we're singing are in German, you really get a sense of Schubert's brilliance, not only with the music, but the texts also that that poets and writers of the day would write and Schubert would put to music. And actually, Franz von Schober, my character, wrote some of the texts. I'm not sure if it was that one, but...
He wrote the text for the last song that will be sung, which is An die Musik,
yes.
A gorgeous song that honors the art of music and, in a sense, is showing us the more serious side of the fun-loving Franz von Schober.
Yeah.
Tell us for just a moment, as someone who has been on the musical theater stage quite a lot, what kind of an interesting challenge and opportunity it's been for you to now be performing in something where, although the dialogue's in English, what you're seeing is in German.
Yeah.
And what kind of a challenge that has meant for you as a performer to try to get comfortable and be expressive in German, not your native tongue.
Yeah, well, at first it presents a sort of challenge where you kind of resent it because it's language you don't understand. It is a song that was written long ago. And for some people, it's hard to really grasp that or, you know, get into that sort of era, that world. But it's been a beautiful experience to sing the music, to translate the words from German into English and begin to understand that this song in a different style could have been written today. But it just so happens that with the progression of, you know, art through the ages that... that Schubert happened to write this specific song or this specific song, but really the emotional attachment that one can feel to a specific song is very similar, whether you're talking about a song today or a song written in Schubert's era. And
it's still somebody in love and somebody who misses their lover. We can all relate to that, and the heart of the feelings expressed are just the feelings that we feel in 2018. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So if anything, it's given me a sense of the commonality of art and artists, and it's been a great experience for me, having sung only in English my whole life. But I still gotta stop singing with an Italian accent, though. That's the thing. That's my problem.
That's right. Melati is certainly an Italian name. But yes, it's great experience for anybody, even somebody who's maybe most comfortable in musical theater and loves most to sing in their own English. It's great for the imaginative muscles, muscles to do this. So we want to remind people again that this opera workshop performance is going to be Saturday afternoon, 3 o'clock, in Carthage's Recital Hall. We want to say that the performance is going to be in what's called immersive style, which means that the audience will be sitting pretty much right with the performers, so the action will be happening right around you, and there'll be food and drink, and it should be a great time and an opportunity also to experience some of the most splendid songs of the great Franz Schubert at one of the Schubertiads that were held in his honor while he was alive and a part of the musical scene of Vienna, Austria. Again, Saturday afternoon, 3 o'clock. Admission is free. And Joey Bellotti is one of the talented students at Carthage who is in the cast. Joey, thank you so much.
If I may make one quick joke, Greg, a pun, actually. Don't miss this opportunity.
That's a pretty bad.
I've been waiting to say that all week.
Okay. All right. Well, I wish I could snip it up, but no, that's pretty good. Joey Bellotti, thank you for being part of the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
All right. On to part two on WGTD. Just a little taste of Schubert's Erlkönig, one of the songs that will be performed Saturday afternoon at Carthage's Opera Workshop. The time is 8:24, and it is time now for part two of today's program here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio.
And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about a really amazing one-man play that is going to be performed tomorrow night at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Parkside's Professor Jonathan Shaler, who's been a frequent guest on the morning show, alerted me to this. And the name was very familiar to me, Stephen Wolfert, because he came to Carthage College, where I teach, last year to present this one-man show and to work with some veterans on campus. And so he is at Parkside today, tomorrow, to work with a number of different classes, different students, a workshop for veterans. He's going to visit the Racine Correctional Institution, where Jonathan Shaler has done his amazing Shakespeare in Prison project. And then tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the main stage in the Rita at UW Parkside, he will present his one-man show called Cry Havoc, which touches on a lot of different issues from his own personal life, including the shock and trauma that he experienced while in the military when he witnessed the accidental fatal shooting of his very, very best friend, and how he tried to come to terms with that heartache and trauma. And that was an effort that eventually led him to Shakespeare and to theater. And now, through a program he founded called DeGroot, he works with veterans and brings them into this experience of Shakespeare. And he is a professional actor otherwise in New York City and has done this one-man show all across the country. And we're fortunate indeed that it comes again to southeastern Wisconsin again tomorrow night at the University of Wisconsin Parkside on their main stage. It's an event sponsored by, in part, by the Parkside Veterans Association. And Stephen Wolfert, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
Really glad to have you here. You have traveled by vehicle all the way from the East Coast to the Midwest, so I appreciate you making time for this. And the jet lag doesn't seem to be affecting you too badly. So
van lag.
Right, yeah, van lag. There we go. No, glad you can be here. Before we talk about this one-man show called Cry Havoc, I think some of what it talks about will make more sense if we can get kind of a capsule summary of who you are and kind of the main events of your life, which in a sense form the framework for your one-man show.
Mm-hmm. The framework of the show is also the framework of the work that I do, and it all begins with the roots of theater, which are telling our story, right? So what my story was that right after the first Gulf War, that, as you mentioned, a dear friend of mine being killed in training, and I realize now looking back that I was having a bit of a break, to put it mildly, and I ended up seeing Shakespeare's Richard III. Now, I didn't come from a theater background. I'm from La Crosse, Wisconsin, just across the state. I grew up in a community that wasn't really big fans of theater. It was in fact, you were usually made fun of if you went to it or participated in it, at least the group with which I hung out. And so I had never really been to a play before. So when I went to see Shakespeare's Richard III and to see a veteran on stage talking about exactly what I was experiencing, I had what I now know is a catharsis. It so profoundly transformed me that I eventually left the Army and went to graduate school for acting, became a professional actor, and the entire time working on Shakespeare plays, finding my story and other veteran stories in these plays, not having I would say I wasn't exposed to them, but I would say that I was more – his plays were inflicted on me at a younger age, you know. They weren't opened up to me, or at least I wasn't open to them. Now, for whatever reason, I was. And I was finding healing. I was finding true emotional and psychological transformation. Of course, physical – the classical actor training is also a physical act as well. So I was seeing me change from this – boy from Wisconsin that became a soldier, now transforming once again into this other me that I didn't know what it was yet. And this became the work of DeGroot. And I came up with DeGroot because I realized that when I was working with Twyla Tharp in New York, She was talking about how her dancers, I was trying to make her dancers move like soldiers for Moving Out, the production that became Moving Out. And they couldn't do it. And we're talking, I was working with them 4 hours a day, every day, 6 days a week for months, and they couldn't quite get it. And I realized it wasn't basic training, but they were just a little off. And she said, no, look, they've been wired to be dancers since the age of 4, 5, and 6. And that's when it hit me. A light went off. Right. I was wired for war in the military.
To be a soldier.
To be a soldier. 7 years of training to respond automatically to these combat stimuli. And then when I got out, there wasn't any unwiring. And so I talk about how we have a recruiter going into the military, but no decruiter coming back out of the military. So that's where the work came from. And the show, Cry Havoc, was very much a quest, what so many solo shows are, which I think everyone should do them. I really do. I think every human being, whether you're a theater person or not, should do a solo show, because it started as a me asking a question about myself of what's wrong with me? Why do I behave like this? And then the show grew from that, working with professional directors and choreographers and what have you, Shakespeare text analysts or analyzers and so on. It became the show, and then the work, then working with psychiatrists and psychologists, bringing all of that work together, became the work of Decruit.
I watched it and I was really blown away, and I realized that I've seen very few one-man shows over the years, or solo shows, and never one quite like this, and I just wasn't really prepared for what it would be. I think a lot of us, when we hear the word one-man show or solo show, we just kind of picture, I don't know, Billy Crystal on a stage with a microphone talking about his life and perhaps, assuming some different voices and so on. But your one-man show, Cry Havoc, is not that. It is not just you standing on a stage talking. Well, for one thing, you're very seldom standing on the stage. Right. I mean, you're a whirling dervish of movement and sound effects and just the way it plays out is quite unconventional and really dramatic and powerful. Was it like that right from the start? I mean, did you, from the moment you began work on this, conceive it in that way, or did that kind of come about over time?
It definitely came about over time. I don't, there's been so many incarnations, and it's been so long. I mean, it started as my graduate thesis all the way back in '97, where I knew we had to do a performance piece for our thesis, as well as a written piece. And our limit was 45 minutes, and I knew from before I entered graduate school at Trinity Rep in Providence, Rhode Island, I knew that I was going to do Shakespeare's Richard III. I didn't know how, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I cut it.
And this is the play that you saw in Montana.
This is the play that changed my life forever, right. So I cut it to 45 minutes. And the guy who directed my show, Cry Havoc, Eric Tucker, he was actually at Trinity Rep at that time. We cut it to 45 minutes, Shakespeare's Richard III, did it as a two-person version with musical numbers, and I lifted a bunch of Shakespeare's monologues, Richard's monologues specifically, and put in my own story. So it was sort of a inverted version of what you see now. So it had its origins all the way back then. Then when I worked on it, what you saw was the three things that built this piece were me asking that question of what's wrong with me? I also always wanted to be a dancer. That was my original dream as early as I can remember. So I wanted the piece to be a movement piece. So when I rehearse, there'll be a day where I just rehearse the movement of it. So I wanted everything as articulated as the language is. So every movement, every gesture, to be as clean and to be its own story as well.
Right.
And that was purely selfish. I just wanted to do that. It wasn't some grand scheme of this is what I want the audience to see. And the other part of it was from the very beginning, from when I started graduate school, I didn't hear or see Shakespeare the way my peers did, or at least I didn't think I did. They weren't veterans. So I was hearing these pieces in a different way. You know, when we talked about, I remember we went over Henry V's famous Crispian's Day speech about we few, we happy few, we band brothers. Everyone seems to know that. passage at least. And it was talked about in this really, you know, patriotic and we're going to die, but at least we're dying together and for our country. And the truth is, that's not how I read it. And nor when I've had experiences that weren't like that, but close, fairly close a number of times, and we didn't behave like that. We didn't see that thing as, yeah, we'll peel up our sleeves and show our scars. It wasn't this. It was much different. Somber isn't the comprehensive enough word, but it was a much different feeling. So all of these pieces resonated differently with me, I felt. So I brought the pieces that really connected to stories in my life, brought those together with the stories, and started performing live in front of an audience without a script. Mm. I had the pieces performance ready, but then I just started interweaving them all the way back like 7 years ago in Los Angeles in front of live audiences. Wow. And making it up.
Without a net. In the New York Times article about your play, which is a really interesting, illuminating article, Eric Tucker, who is your friend from graduate school and director of this, at least to some extent, is quoted as having watched one of your earliest versions of Cry Havoc and basically said words to the effect of, boy, there's a lot of you have a lot of emotions up there, but I didn't.
Yeah,
meaning
yeah.
Meaning that I think what he was probably getting at was that maybe at that point in time, this was maybe a little bit of an exercise, and I don't know what, maybe self-indulgence.
Yeah.
I mean, like all of this emotional work was important to you, but you hadn't maybe yet found a way to convey that to the audience, so the audience is feeling something just as intensely as you're feeling it on the stage.
Yes, this is an excellent example of what I mean by the my work is the work of D. Crute. Early on in Cry Havoc, you know, I was telling personal stories, so I was having these massive floods of emotion sometimes.
Mm, sure.
In particular, when Marcus was killed, the part he was talking about there was. When I performed Lady Percy's speech, her husband, it's from Henry IV, Part 1, her husband is a combat veteran. He's returned home just a week ago from combat, and he's leaving the next morning, unbeknownst to her. And she asks him questions that are the best description of post-traumatic stress disorder I've ever read in the English language.
Wow.
So much so, and it was written 400 years ago, so much so that Jonathan Shea, in his book Achilles in Vietnam, lifts this speech out, puts it in his book, and next to each question that she asks her husband, next to each question, he puts symptoms out of the DSM, the Diagnostic Manual Describing Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. So when I was giving this speech, I thought of my own wife and what she's gone through with me and all these significant others, these spouses and partners of all these veterans throughout the ages, and it would consume me with grief, and I would barely be able to get through the monologue even. So Eric, one of his notes was exactly what you described there, where you're having tons, but we need to have it. So the reason I say that describes the work is I had to go through that crucible. I had to go through all of those emotions because I'd really gotten myself to a place to where I wasn't having any. I mean, that's part of what the military is about. And I'm not condemning it. I'm not deifying or demonizing it. I'm saying to do our job well, what's the mantra? Drive on, drive on. Doesn't mean a thing. Just drive on, drive on. So we're you know, scientifically shrinking our hippocampus, right? We're reducing the amount of emotions we're having. We're training ourselves to have less emotions, or at least to not let our emotions consume or be in the driver's seat. So we choke them off. Well, now I'm opening it up, and they're in the driver's seat. They're taking over completely. So I arguably had to go that far just to open all of that back up so that then I could get to a place of what in the scientific world we call self-regulation, to where I could have the emotions, have them fully, feel them head to toe, inside and out, but they're not in charge. They're just information. I'm just driving through the emotions to tell the story. And now, 7 years later, hundreds of performances later, there are some nights where the well is dry. And I'll talk about, you know, my friend being killed, and I'm not I won't say I feel nothing, because that the beauty of this work, you can't be in front of an audience and feel nothing. It just, you're over feeling everything. But I'm not consumed by grief. I'm actually have come out the other side, and now I'm just telling the story and reliving it to a degree. But even in the moment, when it happened, I wasn't consumed with grief. I went into action. I was on my three radios calling the appropriate people, checking his pulse, making sure he had an airway. You know, there was no time for emotion. I had to work. But now I've given myself the time and the space to have the emotions, and now I'll give the audience the time and space to have their emotions and to fill in the blanks of what tough times they've been through and with whom.
Right. One of the things that's interesting in watching a video of your play, Cry Havoc, is that there are moments when that audience, whatever that audience was for whom you were performing it when it was recorded, there are moments where they are laughing at things that aren't particularly funny. And I think it's partly because it is such a, in a sense, kind of like a hyper-dramatic presentation. I mean, it's just incredible. But in many cases, we don't know what's kind of coming up next. Yeah. And probably just out of kind of sheer surprise, sometimes there's kind of this, I suppose it's really nervous laughter more than anything. But I just wonder what that's like for you on the stage. How conscious are you of that in terms of the reactions of the audience, and particularly when they're probably in the midst of just trying to make sense of all that's going on in front of them?
Yeah, hyper-conscious is the answer. Yeah. Because the nature of this show was to be just me and the actor-audience relationship, as Tina Packer talks about at Shakespeare and Company. It's just me and the audience and the story. That's it. And again, Eric, the director, was a big driver of this. I would freak out and start to say, well, what about rear projections, you know, of the or projections on the rear wall from a camera or from a projector? Nope, just you and the audience. And then it's simpler. And now I can see, and we ask that the house lights be up so that I can see the audience. So I can see and hear them in real time. If someone's phone's going off, I'm not pretending it's not going off. We're going to deal with it. Not attacking them either, because it's just us in the room. The video that you're referring to on the website, that's a rarefied experience, because that was filmed at LaGuardia Community College for the veterans there. So the house was filled with mostly, I would say, about three-quarters veterans.
Wow.
So you've nailed it. It's very astute of you, because they're laughing at stuff that other people don't laugh at.
Right.
And they're hollering out when I'm doing push-ups. 1, 2, 3. They're yelling with me.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had that ever before. So on the film, you're seeing things that happen only when I'm with vet-only audiences. And I do that for as part of Cry Havoc, but I'm sorry, my work with Decrute. But when it's public, the veterans tend to be quiet and just stick alone. But yeah, the audience, there are. You know, I try to have comedy, and some of it's dark comedy.
Right. No. There's a lot that is quite humorous, and it's interesting too. I read in that New York Times article about you that during high school you had this private dream, desire to be a dancer that was just unheard of in that small community where you were growing up. So you pursued martial arts instead. And it sure seems like we see at least vestiges of your work in martial arts in the way that you tear around that stage and use your body.
I talked about in the show just briefly that I was also paralyzed in high school, temporarily paralyzed.
In a wrestling accident.
Yep. And the martial arts is what helped me, part of what helped me regain full mobility back, and in fact be able to join the military. So it's been a part of my life since I was 15, the martial arts, and every part of it, the philosophy as well, that mindset of going through the fire and coming back out cooler, going in, but yeah, I'm going to fight and tear everything up, and then eventually at this point of, nah. I have the skills, but I choose not to use them. And it's been a big influence of mine. The movement has always been. We're in radio, but you can see that I'm writhing around in my seat. And when I talk, I use my hands, and I'm practically hitting the microphone and fidgeting, because I've just been a very kinesthetic person. Got in trouble in school, couldn't sit still.
Right. And again, that this is the big surprise when I watched your show. Is that I was expecting, I don't even really know why, but I was expecting a solitary figure, of course, but relatively stationary on the stage. Yeah. I just never dreamt that I would be seeing something that was physically frenetic. Yes. I mean, and I mean that in the best sense of the word. I mean, it's just incredible. And I'm not surprised to hear you say that you rehearse every movement as much as you rehearse every word.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't even be offended if you meant frenetic in a negative way, because it's who I am. The show, the whole point of the show, I mean, look, solo shows, you mentioned the word indulgent earlier, and they are. It's me, and I believe I have a story to tell, and you're here to listen. Well, it is. We have made an agreement, so tell it. Why hide? Why try to pretend it's something that it's not? I grew up with Lily Tomlin, Whoopi Goldberg, you know, even Carol Burnett's show, but even though she didn't do solo, but I remember at the end when she'd come out with a mop bucket. And these were my influences, Robin Williams, you know, the way he would just go off into the audience. So I had all these influences and that informed the kind of artist I wanted to be. But for me to be up there, to be honest, would have to be, okay, here I am. I'm a mess. I'm not saying it's okay. I'm saying I'm a mess. I'm not going to pretend I'm not. And here's why I think I am. Help me travel through my story to figure out how I got to be this mess. That's it. And it's not judgment. It's not a fault. I'm not saying, oh, this person did this to me and that person. It's not. It's here's what happened. What's wrong with me became what happened to me. And that's the story. And it's just a slice of my life. It's one short slice. In fact, I don't feel the way I no longer feel the way that I did when I wrote the play. And that's, the power of theater. Right. That took me through a journey of healing, telling my story, revisiting my story and asking the question, is that true? Is that really true? Because on stage, I'm trying to be more honest, and that's why we've removed all the barriers. I mean, when I first started, I had boots and a jacket and a shirt on. Now it's just a yoga T-shirt, yoga pants, and that's it. I'm barefoot. I'm trying to be bare before the audience to say, this is it. Let's take a journey. And the challenge is, can I provide enough energy and enough information to where your imagination takes off? Because your imagination is far more powerful than any words that I can come up with. And so then my movement is really, like I said, it's a byproduct. It's not for any intended effect on the audience. It's just that's the way I act.
That's who you are.
Yes, that's me. This is me. Judge away. People do, and that's okay.
Right. We're speaking with Stephen Wolfert, who is going to be performing tomorrow night at the University of Wisconsin Parkside on the Rita's main stage, his one-man show called Cry Havoc, an appearance sponsored in part by the Parkside Veterans Association. This one-man show springs out of some important events in Stephen Wolfert's life, including his time in the military and the trauma of seeing his best friend fatally wounded in a military exercise. And in the wake of that trauma and heartache, Stephen Wolfert found Shakespeare and has been very active in theater ever since, now a professional actor in the New York City area, and also involved in this group that he founded called Decruit. Let's talk for just a couple of minutes about this notion of theater and often Shakespeare playing a role, a very important role, in the lives of some of these veterans with whom you work. Generally speaking, what happens when you are working with veterans in your program called Decruit? What kinds of things are you doing with them, and with what effect?
What we're doing, the reason I went, is because there's so many tiers to each, everything you just asked. Let me start with the last thing you asked. What is the effect? Thanks to Dr. Alicia Ali and Bruce Homer out of NYU and CUNY, respectively, they're psychologists, research and clinical psychologists, and they are actually assessing or scientifically evaluating the work that I do with Decruit through EEGs, electroencephalograms, heart rate variability, and self-disclosure surveys, standard depression, PTS, and self-efficacy surveys. And the results have been profound. I figured they would be, because for a decade and a half or more, I was doing this and getting the testimonials. But I really wanted the scientific data, and luckily I found them. They helped me formalize Decruit to where it could be manualized, where other people can teach it, to where it can be standardized. Every class is roughly the same. Therefore, we can test it and go, okay, the results are pretty consistent. Not because, oh, I forgot this or this person teaches it differently, but rather the standard formula of the way we teach it. And what we're teaching is classical actor training, I don't want to say journaling because it gets such a bad name, self-prompted writings, and Shakespeare. That's it. It's classical actor training in that the mindfulness, to be able to stand, take up space, breathe. We call it reclaiming our toddler pose or our toddler selves. Before, we had the societal pressures to cross our arms or to hunch or put our hands in our pockets or any of that. What's it like to just stand and observe a toddler when they the belly's hanging out, the full body's breathing, the body is present. They're not doing anything to change the way they're perceived with the world because they're only taking in the world. They're breathing through their mouth. Their lips are parted and their lower jaw is hanging open. And this is what we're going for. The reason being, not that I want them to walk around like they belong on the set of The Walking Dead, but rather to go back to that, to find there's all these terms. Neutral isn't a correct word. But the military readiness position is one of ready to react, to respond to something. And what we want is a ready position that's more ready to take in what's in the world, rather than a hypervigilance and observation without judgment, rather than assessing where's that person going, just observing there's a person and they're going there. It's a big ask. So, pardon me, just being in the room with a group of veterans provides a level of security, if I can put it like that, to allow them to take a moment or two, or even if they're fleeting, to actually feel that, to observe their own body, to turn their focus inward without judgment. And that really is the tenet of theater. And I learned that largely from both Shakespeare and Company and the indigenous performance culture here in North America, the Algonquin with Yvette Nolan up in Canada and Randy Reinholds in Los Angeles, how the Native American theater community uses theater as medicine. They embrace it openly. They don't say, well, it's therapeutic, but it's not therapy. They say, no, it's therapy. The roots of theater are in psychology. The roots of theater are in warriors telling their stories and healing. Whether we look at the ancient Athenians, all of whom were veterans, Sophocles, Aeschylus, they were all veterans who fought in horrific battles and entire campaigns, and primarily against the Persians, and then wrote about it as plays to tell their community, this is what this war was like. And the entire community could then hear that story and be closer to them. And they could begin to empathize with each other, the family vets, the vets themselves, the cadets, the future vets. And then somewhere along the line, we've separated theater and psychology, and we separated theater from healing. So what I'm doing is bringing them back together. So what they can expect is to come in, do basic mindfulness practices, which whether you do yoga or qigong or martial arts or theater or anything that requires you to stop, ground, breathe in, and turn your focus inward for just a moment to check in, and then turn your focus back out. That simple practice before we enter the space on stage or whether we speak. Then we're speaking Shakespeare. And they get the Shakespeare. I've taken 22 monologues when I work with veterans. I have different lumps, packets for different groups that I work with. For veterans, there's 22 Shakespeare monologues that I've lifted and edited down. And I equate them with specific thoughts, feelings, and emotions that veterans have, whether it's combat, PTS, or whether it's just transition, basic transitional issues, whether it's childhood trauma that was exacerbated by the military, whatever it is, lifted 22 monologues. I don't cast them. They, through self-disclosure and writing, they share what they're battling with, what they're struggling with the most at the moment. And that's the other premise of theater, is to make a choice. Just make a decision, because in theater, it's not life or death. It feels like life or death, but the military's on that binary. But in theater, we get to play in that middle ground. So they get to make a choice and say, well, I'm battling this the most today. And they realize, oh, I can just pick something and no one dies. And we run with that. They get a monologue and then they begin speaking it. And what we do is we stay very strict about the verse, not because to honor Shakespeare, but to stay in self-regulation. So let's say we're using Hamlet's To Be or Not to Be, which is And it's for each person to describe or to share, rather, what they think it's about. I'm not telling them, okay, you're at an antechamber before the palace. I don't know what an antechamber is. I'm an American. I've never been to a castle. So rather, I decontextualize them. I lift them from the play and give it to them. Ask them to read, breathing in before each new line of verse. And then they tell us what they think it means. Within 1 to 3 readings, they're nailing it. Even if it's not nailing it by – I don't mean – oh, they're getting what I think it means. They're nailing it in that they are making a personal connection to it, completely relating to it. And by speaking it, in my case, to be or not to be was multiple bouts of suicidal ideology, where the to be or not to be, that is the question. To breathe in there, to keep breathing in as Shakespeare wrote it, keeps me in self-regulation. I can talk about very heightened moments, moments in my life where I wanted to die. I can share them in public with strangers and yet keep my sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous systems from going back into that old hypervigilance, going back into that childhood trauma, going back into that military training, because Shakespeare's writing forces us to do that. To be or not to be, that is the question. Breathe in. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep. By asking me to breathe in before each new line, I can share a really complex thought, really personal thought, a deeply troubling feeling. But by breathing in, I'm forcing the air in and bringing my heart rate back down, bringing my sympathetic nervous system back into regulation so that I can handle the emotions that I'm dealing with.
Real quick, how many of the veterans you work with are completely new to theater, let alone Shakespeare? And what is that experience like for them? I mean, and going in, how skeptical are they that this can be as powerful as you are describing?
The vast majority have no experience with Shakespeare, and if they do, it's usually negative. I would say without exaggeration, less than 10% have any interest in being actors. I've worked with hundreds, and in fact, some come with such skepticism. I'll share with you what a guy shared with us at Samaritan Village in New York. It's an in-house treatment center for veterans, specifically male veteran population. This guy at his in front of the audience, when he's about to do his final performance, which is part of the Decrute final class, he's about to perform his Shakespeare piece, and he said, you know, I came down to the circle to make fun of these guys. I came down to give this guy a hard time, and he's pointing to me, saying, you know, Shakespeare, treatment of trauma, whatever. And he goes, and it changed my life.
Wow.
That's the experience that we've been getting from the vast majority of the veterans that we work with.
Incredible. You have a website where people can learn more about Decrute. And I encourage people to visit it. I don't remember the address of it.
www.decrute.org. Decrute, like recruit, but with a D.
Yeah, D-E-C-R-U-I-T.
Correct.
And we want to remind people then that your one-man show, your solo show, Cry Havoc, is going to be performed tomorrow night on the main stage at UW Parkside's Rita, 7 o'clock, sponsored by the Parkside Veterans Association. I know lots of people are very, very excited about this opportunity to see your show. And I assume you're going to take a little time to talk with the audience afterwards?
Yes, every single performance has we just have the one here, but I always do a talk back so the community can meet the veterans in their community right after.
Very good. Stephen Wolfert, I so appreciate you joining us today on The Morning Show to talk about your life and Decrute and this one-man play, Cry Havoc. It's been great to speak with you. Very best wishes to you.
Thanks for having me.
Also being performed this weekend, the musical The Addams Family at Carthage College in the V-PAL, which is next to the art gallery. The performances are officially sold out, but I understand that there's a small number of tickets that are held just ahead of each performance for latecomers. You can go to carthage.edu and get more information. And one more reminder of Carthage's opera workshop presentation, which is Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock in the recital hall, called To Schubert, Recreating a Schubertiade in the Early 19th Century, celebrating the legacy of the great Franz Schubert and his marvelous songs. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Tomorrow on the morning show, Jack Gressel and Jill Jensen. They'll be on hand to talk about their most recent recording, a really delightful collection of holiday songs,